This morning I want to share on a subject that is near and dear to my heart. It's been with me for many years. The principle of beauty and the principle of art in the life of the Christian specifically, but just kind of in general. So I want to kind of touch on that this morning. Way back when, I'm going to age myself, I was a freshman in college as an undergrad in 1986, 87, and I attended a class that really kind of revolutionized me in many ways and set a course for study and experience and things like that. I was, just an 18-year-old kid trying to find his way, and this really had a great impact on me. And the class was on the topic of beauty, the philosophy of beauty, the topic of beauty. It's known as aesthetics. And so in that class, I was introduced to a classical composer named Felix Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn was a German composer who lived in the early part of the 1800s, and I was introduced to him, and specifically I was introduced to a piece that he wrote called The Hebrides Overture, or Fingal's Cave. And back then, we had cassettes, we had record players, and the professor took the record out, and he started playing these notes in this overture. And it really rocked my world in a lot of ways, not just because of the music, but because of the story that came behind the music itself. Mendelssohn was a young man at the time. He was around 21 years of age, and he toured the area of Scotland called the Hebrides Islands, the chain of islands called the Hebrides. And specifically, he was going to this place called Fingal's Cave on the island of Staffa in 1829. And Fingal's Cave is this amazing creation of God. Walter Scott described it in a way that I'll mention in a second, but it looks like a cathedral when you get in there. It rises perhaps around 227 feet up. So when you're in there, and it's fairly narrow, in a boat, it just kind of reaches beyond you. And you can see the sort of the waves and just the symmetry. It almost looks like a pipe organ inside of this cave. Walter Scott said, "It was one of the most extraordinary places I have ever beheld. It exceeded in my mind every description I had heard of it. Composed entirely of basaltic pillars as high as the roof of a cathedral and running deep into the rock, eternally swept by a deep and swelling sea and paved, as it were, with ruddy marble, it baffles all description." And as we know, when we see photos of something, they usually don't come close to what something looks like and feels like in person. So Mendelssohn takes a trip, and he goes on a big boat. The day that he went was a very stormy day. It was a very stormy day, and Scotland and northern UK is also always very stormy, but this was crazy. And so most people weren't going to go see the cave, because you had to get off the boat, big boat, and go take a little boat. But he decided with his buddy to get into a little boat and go into this cave, even though it was stormy, and I think everyone on the big boat and the small boat were just vomiting left and right. It was just a complete mess. And so he gets into this cave, and he experiences all sorts of things. He sees this amazing picture of creation, right? This cathedral, this natural cathedral. But you can imagine inside the cave, especially with the storm itself, the acoustics must have been amazing. Right, the waves crashing. There were seagulls very high up into the roof area of the cave itself. But because of the storm, he was terrified for his life. I mean, he kind of barely made it out of there, and so he had these huge mixed feelings of joy and terror at the same time. He was completely in awe of what he was seeing, and so shortly after this, he composed this overture about Fingal's Cave. And so I'm sitting there, this 18-year-old, and he starts to play this. And the notes were just amazing. I mean, I really felt like I was with him in the cave. Sort of the way the waves will come up and down. There's a repetition and a rotation of melody that goes over and over. There's a rise and there's a fall of sound. He creates these high strings in the overture to kind of duplicate the seagulls. There's calm, there's chaos, just all the things that you would experience in this cave, he duplicated in many ways through music. And so I was really turned on through this music, but also through the class itself, about the power of beauty. The power of beauty. Beauty has an amazing amount of power over our lives, whether we necessarily realize it or not. There's power certainly in the natural wonders like Fingal's Cave or a mountain range. Certainly we think of beauty in terms of physical beauty when it comes typically to women. There's men are attracted to beautiful women. Women pursue physical beauty. That's certainly a big category of beauty in our life and in our culture. This is a category of beauty. The Williams, Evan and Ludmilla and Timmy and I and Zola, we all went to Gracias. People were coming up, so they saw it on Facebook. Spent a couple days in Gracias Lempira this week, and it's just this beautiful part of the country. It was wonderful to see all these sights and these sounds, the natural wonders of the park that was nearby. But if you look at an image like this and you don't think it's beautiful, I would encourage you to expand and broaden your category of beauty, because this is a beautiful image of this man. There was all sorts of color that we saw in the town and around in the area, these artistic works like Mendelssohn, these paintings, this color. Everywhere we looked, we saw all sorts of beauty. And certainly we talk about the idea of artistic beauty when it comes to Christianity and religion. This is Michelangelo's Creation of Man, the Sistine Chapel, something many consider to be beautiful. Another Michelangelo sculpture, the Pieta in Rome, Mary holding the dead body of Jesus. The stained glass walls in Paris, the Cathedral of Notre Dame. These are things that are immensely beautiful, immensely beautiful. And then this is an actual photo that I took. And again, the photos don't do it justice, and we also have kind of the washed out thing with the screen that you really can't see how beautiful this truly was. We were driving along the Blue Ridge Parkway in North Carolina and pulled over, and there was this amazing kind of Fingal's Cave moment, right? The light was mixing with the darkness, the clouds and the mist were flowing over the mountains, and I absolutely kind of felt that sense of astonishment and awe when we experience something that is so much bigger than us, in the way that, for instance, Mendelssohn did in the cave. There was a sense of transcendence in this experience of beauty. And then, as you saw in the title slide, we have this. This is the Ark of the Covenant. If you're not familiar with the Ark of the Covenant, this was the dwelling place of God. God's glory, God's Spirit dwelled in the Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle in the Old Testament. And this Ark of the Covenant, this beautiful work of art and craftsmanship, was created by a human artist. An artist created this. Bezalel is the name. If you study this, you study the story of Exodus through most of the chapters. It's a story of the wilderness and Egypt and all that. But the latter parts of Exodus are about Bezalel. They're about Bezalel as an artist being commissioned to create and design, according to God's specifications, this work of art in the Ark of the Covenant, the work of art of the tabernacle. He was commissioned as an artist to do this along with a team of other people. Bezalel says in Exodus 31, "I have called by name Bezalel of the tribe of Judah, and I have filled him with the Spirit of God, with ability and intelligence and knowledge and all craftsmanship, to devise artistic designs, to work in gold, silver, bronze, in cutting stones for setting, in carving wood, to work in every craft." Now, most people who are good at a craft will tell you that it often takes years and practice to really become good at one thing. This guy was good at a bunch of stuff. And if you look elsewhere in Exodus, you see that he was also good at embroidery and making clothes. They would make the priestly garments, these beautiful garments that the priests would wear. He was empowered by the Spirit of God as an artist to create all these beautiful things. And so this is sort of a rendering of the tabernacle in the wilderness. You see in the center was the tent, and then inside the tent was the Ark of the Covenant that was made with wood, it was made with gold. You see the outer area where the walls are built with these satin and cloth curtains that were just absolutely beautiful. So this was essentially God's house. And God was decorating his house, so to speak, because these instructions are given in an immense amount of detail and specificity. You know, Bezalel and his team were the ones that did this, but it was according to the instructions of God. This is what you should do. This is how you should adorn my house. And it was just this beautiful thing. It was furniture. It was utensils for the sacrifices. Just all the things that you might put in a house. This was included in the tabernacle. In the Ark of the Covenant. Just this beautiful thing that embodied the Spirit of God. This was created in the Old Testament. Bezalel. The Ark itself, some people will say, well, we don't want to decorate our church. We don't want to do too much to adorn things that are Christian or spiritual because of the dictate that we don't create images of God himself. Well, in the Old Testament, they didn't do that. The Ark of the Covenant is this amazing thing because it included God's presence, but God himself is not depicted. You see, the surface of the Ark itself is called the mercy seat. Above that are the two cherubim who, it says, they overshadow the mercy seat. And so within that space was this invisible God. The art was pointing to God, but it wasn't necessarily depicting the image of God. And that's really what a good, holy, or spiritual artist does, is we create an environment, we create beauty that points to the invisible God. And I think that's what Bezalel did here. The Ark was also something that maybe similar to Mendelssohn's experience, created both joy and terror, right? It was a holy thing. The wrong person could not touch the Ark of the Covenant. The wrong person could not gaze upon God's glory and God's presence, right? Death could occur. However, it was this amazingly out-of-reach, beautiful thing that pointed to the transcendent of the holy, divine God. This is Bezalel. The word Bezalel, the name Bezalel, in the Hebrew, literally means in the shadow of God. In the shadow of God, and you can see the title, in the shadow of the Almighty. This comes from Psalm 91. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God, in whom I trust. The word shadow for the most often gives a negative connotation. It's about darkness, right? Shadows aren't so much good things. But in the biblical context, it's used in all sorts of different ways. It can be used as the idea of reflection. A shadow is a reflection, right? The law, the Mosaic law, is called a shadow of Christ. Christ is the real thing. The law was a shadow or a reflection of Christ. That's one way that it's used. In this case, it's used as the idea of shelter. Under the shadow of God, under the shadow of the Almighty, in the same way that a mother bird would take her wing and cover her baby bird. We are under the protection of God when we are in his presence, right? We experience the joy of God in his protection, his provision, when we are in his shadow. So when I experience God's beauty, I am in his shadow. So I love the fact that the man who was commissioned to create all these works of beauty was named in the shadow of God. You hear the word beauty, and maybe you first heard it this morning and said, you know what? That's not such a good thing. And certainly, like everything that God has created, beauty has to be approached with caution. It has to be approached carefully. When beauty is about us, when it's self-focused, when it's just about the things of the earth, and God is detached from it, then it leads to corruption, right? God created all these great things, but they've been corrupted when it becomes just about us. And the same thing applies to beauty. Proverbs 31, charm is deceitful. Beauty is in vain. But a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. So, self-reflective beauty. If the beauty just points to me or to the object itself and doesn't point to God, right, then it's in vain. It's deceitful. It's corrupt. All flesh is grass, Isaiah 40. And all its beauty is like the flower of the field. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers. The flower fades. But the word of our God will stand forever. So beauty, human beauty on its own terms, is temporary. So there's this huge amount of pressure, for instance, on women to be quote-unquote beautiful. There's this huge amount of pressure about men that are attracted to beautiful women. But all this is vain when it's on our own terms, when it's simply human. However, that doesn't mean we throw the baby out with the bathwater. Beauty is still something that can be pursued and should be pursued because it really does lead us to God. We can have a God-focused beauty. Beauty, there's nothing wrong with beauty when it's reflecting God. Psalm 96, splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. God is beautiful. We can reflect on God. Isaiah 28, in that day, the Lord of hosts will be a crown of glory and a diadem of beauty to the remnant of his people. Psalm 27, this is David. He says, one thing I have asked of the Lord, that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. Why? To gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. So the presence of the Lord, the things that the Lord creates and touches are beautiful. Fingal's Cave was beautiful. The view we had on that mountain range in the Smokies was absolutely beautiful because the Creator had connected to it. The Creator had touched it, had formed it. And so it pointed to God. It was God-focused beauty. And so the same thing with the Ark of the Covenant, a man-made thing, this artistic thing that God had commissioned someone to craft was beautiful, certainly because it contained the glory and the presence of God, but God was in it. Right? It was God-focused beauty. So if you've heard me before, I talk about apologetics and reasons to defend and believe in the faith. And there's something called the argument from design, meaning this is a reason that we could believe in God. When we look at the complexity of the world, for instance, human DNA, the stars, the tides, it is natural to seek a cause or a designer behind it. So that's an argument from design. So related to that is an argument from beauty. When we experience the breathtaking beauty of nature and art, shouldn't this point to a transcendent artist or creative agent or, better said, an ultimate creator? The argument from beauty. Beauty should ignite something in us that points to God. And that's the beauty of beauty. The scholar, biblical scholar, Leland Ryken says, although the Bible does not state it explicitly, it is a fair inference that experiences of earthly beauty awaken a longing for a beauty that is more permanent and transcendent than anything this life can give, a longing for the beauty of God. Ecclesiastes 3, God has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. And here's another quote from Einstein. Funny enough. The pursuit of truth and beauty is a sphere of activity in which we are permitted to remain children all our lives. This is a photo from Gracias, Timmy Williams. He's shaking hands with the monkey Lola in Gracias at a little zoo we were at. So often we grow up, right? We become these adults. And being an adult is about having all the answers, having control over our lives, living lives of routine, of expectation. And we lose our sense of wonder. Now, whether a child really thinks about it or not, I think children live lives of wonder. They live lives where they everything is beautiful around them. And the beauty that they see is similar to the beauty that, for instance, Mendelssohn saw. It was something that excited them, that created enjoyment, but the world around them was also terrifying, right? When you're a child, the world is a scary place sometimes. It's beyond you. When an adult stands over you, they just kind of burst through the frame of your vision when you're a little kid. But then we grow up, and we feel like we're to have control over life, that we have, everything is to be expected. And so when we live in a life where we're not experiencing divine beauty through the created works of God or artistic works of God, we're missing it. We're missing the faith and the beauty of childhood, the wonder that takes us to the place of seeing God as so much bigger than we are, His creation as so much bigger than we are, almost a sense of terror, but a terror that draws us to God, not away from God. If you're living a life where you never experience any sense of astonishment or awe, I wonder how close to God you really are. And the beauty of it, though, is that it's right outside. Or it's in the artistic works that we can see that God inspires. Or it's in the people around us where we see the things of beauty that point us to God. Psalm 104. This is a description, I would say, of a beautiful God. O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty, covering yourself with light as with a garment, stretching out the heavens like a tent. He lays the beams of his chambers on the waters. He makes the clouds his chariot. He rides on the wings of the wind. He makes his messengers winds. His ministers of a flaming fire. He set the earth on its foundations so that it should never be moved. This is just a portion of Psalm 104. Look at the integration of the natural world with the characteristics of this divine, transcendent God. You want to look at beauty, read the Bible. Read the Bible. The Bible is certainly divine wisdom and truth and all those things, but the Bible is absolutely a work of art. It's a commissioned work of art, right? The Psalms, what are they? Poetry, full of all this imagery that just excites us, that takes us to a place that simple logic and rules and ways of behavior don't take us to, right? The Psalms, Proverbs, the prophets, the imagery that they bring us into, the way they send us away from our safe little place into the presence of the divine. Places like Revelation and Daniel, the beautiful stories of the Old Testament, the beautiful stories of the Gospels and Acts. These are works of art. These are works of beauty. And if you're someone who says, well, beauty really doesn't have a place in my life, you know, I would challenge you, and I would ask you to inventory how much art do you participate in? How many things do you participate? Are you someone that rebuilds motorcycles? Are you someone that enters into some sort of craft? Or do you go hunting? We could go into all sorts of categories where you probably are experiencing beauty. And you're certainly affected by art. It may not be godly art. And you certainly are affected by beauty, but it may not be godly beauty. So this absolutely affects us and should affect us in a godly way. There is also beauty in connection, in relational connection. Now, this is a drawing that perhaps a New York art critic would not consider to be beautiful, right? But if this was your daughter, if this was your kid, you would post this thing on your refrigerator, you would take a photo of it and put it on Instagram or Facebook and say, look how beautiful this drawing is. Why? Because your child is beautiful to you, right? There's a subjectiveness sometimes to beauty, but beauty is created fundamentally through relational connection. Your daughter is beautiful. The drawing is beautiful. When we grow old, as married couples, objectively, or according to the world's standards, we may not be beautiful. But look at the beauty of connection. The beauty of connection through love, through years. The adoration is still there. We have beauty through connection. This is an image from last Sunday, the wedding of Kelsey and Jared. You can see the beautiful sign that was created. Welcome to Kelsey and Jared's wedding in English and in Spanish. Beautiful craftsmanship created. But what I also want you to see is the little boy standing next to it. Again, if you're not familiar with the story of their wedding, they invited the Micah boys, the boys that they ministered to, they invited girls and others from the village that is nearby, and they bussed in two buses full of street people from the streets of Tegucigalpa that they ministered to on a regular basis, cleaned them up, dressed them up, and invited them to attend this beautiful wedding. The wedding was chaotic. The wedding had lots of unknowns, lots of stuff that we don't necessarily want or expect to see in a formal ceremony, but the wedding was beautiful. The wedding was beautiful, and if you can actually see around the stone area where the bride and the groom are, there's all these kids surrounding them that they invited. And I will tell you that, you know, Liz, Jose, and Caleb and Lauren, if I'd been to your weddings, I'd be bragging on you too. But the beauty of connection, the beauty not just of a bride and groom connecting, but of the gospel, the kingdom being lived out in such a miraculous way. Our ministry, mercy, justice, forgiveness, love, these are beautiful things. The beauty of connection. Some photos from our church. There's beauty when we get together and have a great meal together. This is Ludmilla. She worked with a craftsman at the Micah Project to create these beautiful shelves that we are hanging our coffee cups from in the kitchen area. The ladies, Keisha mentioned the blue room. The blue room used to be the white room. And the white room had no decor or anything. It was just, I'm sure it's been used for different purposes over the years. But the women came in and they painted and they added furniture and different decor. And it was this welcoming place of connection. They use it for study. They use it for prayer. The beauty of connection. Easter morning, there's a wooden cross that for, I think, a few years has been decorated with flowers that the congregation brings to decorate the cross. And if you see in the Exodus account, that's how Bezalel actually does his work, is they say, bring all this stuff. He didn't come up with the material. Everyone brought their own satin and gold and wood to contribute. We are all kind of Bezalel in a way. The beauty of the worship that we heard this morning, the beauty of your voices, right? Again, connection. You might not think you have a great voice, but God does. Connection. The beauty. We are all Bezalels. The beauty of the choir in the park nearby on Easter morning. The beauty of connection, where we welcome those who are tired and poor and desiring of restoration and healing to this church through craftsmanship, right? Through the artistry of our contributions, so they can be artistic, they can be written, they can be spoken. There's all sorts of ways that we can contribute in our own lives to point people to God, to point people to God. God looks upon the congregation and he says, you are beautiful. There's a quote from Augustine that says, the trees, the mountains, right, the trails, they all say that we are beautiful. We are beautiful because God made us. That is why we are beautiful. The beauty of connection. And our beauty is a testimony to God. Our beauty is a testimony to God. And so, like the Ark of the Covenant that contained the Spirit of God, the presence of God, you and I, as Christians, now become God's house. And so, we are adorned with beauty by God's presence, but then we have a choice. We are commissioned as artists. How do we adorn ourselves? How do we dress up ourselves in beauty that points people to God when it comes to who we are? God had a house. We have a house. Most of us decorate our house, right? We use craftsmanship. We create things ourselves. We purchase things. We create a decor that blesses us. Very often it's a decoration that is unique to who we are. We tell stories about ourselves when we decorate our home with photos and different things, right? It blesses people to see the adornment of our house. So how do we adorn ourselves and create beauty as Christians? Different ways. This is not accidentally a title that is related to the title this morning. The Shadow of the Almighty was written by Elizabeth Elliot, and her, if you're a missionary or somebody who studies this, you know that her husband was Jim Elliot. He was a missionary in Ecuador many years ago and was martyred. And that led to God being glorified in a lot of conversions. Jim Elliot was somebody that was in love with God. He was absolutely in love with the beauty of God. But he was in love with God in such a way that everything was pointing to the Almighty. He was under God's shadow in such a way that he could live in the joy of childhood, of wonder, so that he could speak in a way that the gospel would be declared in the way God wanted. He lived in the shadow of the Almighty. One thing he said was, "Lord, make my way prosperous, not that I achieve high station, but that my life may be an exhibit to the value of knowing God." That's one of the ways that he wanted to adorn himself, right? How do I reflect God's image? How do I adorn myself with God's beauty? Isaiah 52, which is quoted in Romans 10 about the gospel of Jesus Christ, says, "How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who publishes peace, who brings good news of happiness, who publishes salvation, who says to Zion, your God reigns." How beautiful are we when we speak these words of good news. And then this is applied to women in 1 Peter, but I think we could all take on this principle. Do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair, the putting on of gold jewelry, or the clothing that you wear. But let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. I think we can all accept that principle. How do we adorn ourselves? This is a beautiful photo, in my view. I'm not sure if I've used it before. It was taken by National Geographic. And this is an Ethiopian priest on an all-night prayer vigil reading the scriptures. Beautiful sight. Beautiful adornment. Another quote from Eliot of Jesus, "I cannot seem to get enough. Thank God, though, he does not thwart the soul's desire for himself, but only whets the desire, intensifying, sublimating." And a famous quote from John Piper, "God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him." The beauty of the world, the self-reflected beauty, promises something. Like beauty, it should awaken the desire that is within us. But the beauty of the world, self-reflected beauty, is an empty promise. It doesn't really fulfill the desire that's awakened within us. But God-reflected beauty absolutely does. Certainly, like Jim Elliot says, it creates a wanting for more. But it satisfies us. It satisfies us to live in that beauty, to live at a place where we pursue worship, nature, art that we are left in complete astonishment and awe and reverence for this holy God living in the shadow of the Almighty. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, you are beautiful. And Lord, I ask that our brains and our hearts and our souls can have an expansive definition of what beauty really is. You have created a beautiful world because you yourself, Lord, are an artist. Whether it's mountains or trees or birds or the platypus, whether it's the human body, whether it's the artworks that we create inside or outside of church, that we can be inspired by the Spirit of God to create God-reflective beauty, to point ourselves and to point others to the living God. Lord, I pray that we can constantly pursue your shadow, to live under your wings, to enjoy your shelter and your protection and your provision and your presence, that life can be beautiful. Beautiful in such a way that we are like the little kid who looks at everything and sees wonder and sees a world that is beyond, but lives in the pureness of joy and excitement and adventure. I pray for these things in the name of Jesus. And I'll leave you with Psalm 84, a couple verses. How lovely is your dwelling place, O Lord of hosts. My soul longs, yes, faints for the courts of the Lord. My heart and flesh sing for joy to the living God. Let that be the position of our hearts this week, that you go forward and see and recognize and pursue the beauty of God everywhere you look. Amen.